people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, or no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish it didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Bukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, November 23, 2011. In the news today, pressure is mounting on the Israeli government to release overdue Palestinian tax money, and the UN approves a draft resolution on Palestine. These stories and more are coming up, so stay tuned. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is under increasing pressure from both the United States and the United Nations to release $200 million in Palestinian tax revenue. The Israeli government has held on to the money since Palestine was voted in as a full member of UNESCO last month. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke with Netanyahu demanding release of the funds, but Netanyahu rejected the request as the majority of his cabinet is against the move. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has advocated that the money be transferred immediately, as the Palestinian Authority needs the funds to help pay their security forces. UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon also put a call into Netanyahu, asking for not only the release of the funds, but to state that settlement activities in the occupied territories and Jerusalem were a violation of international law and would hinder the resumption of any future peace talks in the region. In Gaza overnight, a medical convoy from Tunisia has crossed the strip via the Rafah boarding crossing. Dr. Jalal Ayad, head of the Tunisian Al Amal Hope Society for Social Development, stated that this visit comes in solidarity with the people of Gaza and to challenge the illegal Israeli siege. The convoy will travel throughout the region, delivering medical supplies to several hospitals. In southern Gaza, Israeli fighter planes fired a missile at a former settlement near Rafah, as well as fired upon boats who were fishing in the Palestinian territorial waters. There are no reports of any injuries to the local residents. The PA announced today that a file outlining the plight of Palestinian detainees in Israeli custody was ready to be handed to the International Court. The Minister for Detainees, Isaac Karaka, stated that the Israeli Prison Administration is escalating its attacks and violations and is imposing collective punishment, in addition to depriving the detainees from their basic, internationally guaranteed rights. In New York yesterday, the UN approved a draft resolution on the right of Palestinian people to self-determination. The Mann News Agency reported that the resolution presented by Egypt had the support from 166 states in the UN General Assembly's Social, Humanitarian and Cultural Affairs Committee. The resolution states that Palestinians have a right to an independent state and urged all states, agencies and organisations to support and assist the Palestinian people to realise this right. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, November 23rd daily roundup of the news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This was brought to you by Hassan Kassis and myself, Adam Carey.
Mazen Kumsia, a professor of genetics who worked at several American universities before returning to his native Palestine, is the author of four books, including his latest titled Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. As an activist as well as an academic, Kumsia had hoped to be a passenger on board the most recent ship convoy attempting to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza in early November, but was bumped at the last minute when the Turkish government forced organizers to reduce the number of passengers by two-thirds. Professor Kumsia returned to his home in Beit Sahur near Bethlehem in time to present a talk on the Palestinian struggle to a group of international solidarity activists. Less than a week later, Kumsia was one of six Palestinians arrested when they boarded an Israelis-only bus that brings Israeli settlers from the West Bank into Jerusalem. They called their action the Freedom Rides in reference to dangerous journeys into the American South on interstate buses that black and white civil rights activists undertook in the early 1960s. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended and recorded Kumsia's talk at Beit Sahur's Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People. An excerpt of the talk, which covers the history of the Palestinian nonviolent resistance struggle, is presented here.
People are very familiar with this uprising, 1987 to 1991, which was called the Uprising of the Stones because Palestinian children were using stones, as you can see, there to throw at Israeli soldiers who responded by shooting live ammunition, or when they didn't do that, as Rabin instructed them to, was to break the bones of Palestinians who participate. So they would literally catch people and they would break their long bones intentionally. These are all forms of resistance that Palestinians engage in. For us to exist on this land is to resist, because basically picking olives like we did last month under the circumstances of occupation and colonization, especially in areas where the soldiers and the settlers do not want us to pick our own olive trees, is a form of resistance. When this shepherd woman took her sheep to the field like this, when the soldiers see her up there and the settlers don't want her to do this, that's a form of nonviolent resistance. The settlers even went to the extreme of putting poison pellets for the sheep so that the sheep will eat those and die, and she will have no reason then to continue to go to this field. And yet she continued to go to this field. She continued to pick up these pellets and clean the field. Or these young people having their prayer maybe for the last time at this land which will be confiscated to build colonial settlements. Arguing with soldier when you can see the bulldozer are uprooting olive trees that his great-grandparents had planted. These are all forms of nonviolent resistance. These are all inspiring forms, inspiring acts of what we call in Arabic sumud. Sumud means like persistence, resilience, combination of things. On Palm Sunday, the tradition for us Palestinian Christians, accompanied by Palestinian Muslims, is to go to Jerusalem, to walk to Jerusalem, because Jesus, who's venerated also by Muslims, walked or rode actually on a donkey to enter Jerusalem. So we take palm leaves and things like that, and we walk to Jerusalem. We take donkeys and go to Jerusalem. all the occupiers of Jerusalem before Israel allowed this tradition to continue. Only Israel prevented this tradition in the last few years. I'm talking about the British before Israel, the Jordanians, the Ottomans, the Crusaders even, everybody. You know, everybody who was here occupied this land, allowed this tradition to continue. Only Israel prevented this tradition from happening. So we said to ourselves, no, we were not going to accept this. So we walked to Jerusalem. We took about, you know, I don't remember, 100, 150 people, and we walked. And of course, we pushed the first gate, through the first gate, through the second gate, and we kept going. We reached about 300 meters into the so-called forbidden zone for us, Palestinian Christians and Muslims from Bethlehem. And until they gathered, of course, enough forces to start to arrest us. And actually, the first creatures they arrested was this gentleman, this donkey, and this mule. I kid you not, they arrested the donkey and the mule, and they charged them with illegally entering Jerusalem without a permit. Okay? To enter a donkey into Jerusalem, you need a permit, of course. You know, I start by saying I'm very optimistic. This BDS movement, just as an example, in the last 6 years, from the initial call by Palestinian civil society for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which happened in 2005, in those 6 years, we accomplished more than what South Africa did between the initial call by civil society in South Africa, which was 1955, to the 1980s, over 30 years. So we did in 6 years what South Africa was able to accomplish in 30 years.
That was Palestinian academic, author, and activist Mazen Kumsia presenting a talk on the history of the Palestinian nonviolent resistance struggle. Visit our website at btlonline.org to learn more about Kumsia's work.
Afghanistan, Monday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Monday. NATO is reporting the death of another soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Pakistan, today. Pro-Taliban militants in Pakistan's northwestern Khyber agency have destroyed at least two NATO oil tankers carrying fuel for U.S.-led foreign troops in neighboring Afghanistan, according to Press TV. Pakistan, Sunday. Unknown fighters burned three trucks carrying fuel for U.S. and NATO forces in Pakistan's southwestern Balochistan province, according to police. Baghdad, Iraq, Sunday. Iraqi security forces say U.S. forces killed two Iraqis after an explosion hit their vehicle, according to the report. The Americans opened fire at random, killing two civilians and injuring either three or five. According to AFP, a U.S. military spokesman denies that U.S. forces fired any shots at all. According to Aswan al-Iraq, no Americans were injured in the explosion, but they fired on passing cars, causing the casualties. The Iraqi State News Service is also reporting this incident. Wait a minute. What U.S. vehicle? What roadside bomb? I thought U.S. combat operations in Iraq were over. Oh yeah, that's been said before. Mr. Barack Obama, U.S. troops are supposed to be out of Iraq in a month, and this is still going on? Now is the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home from both wars today, and extradite war criminals who fire on innocent civilians.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
On the 22nd of November, Occupy protesters in Manchester, New Hampshire, shouted down President Obama at one of his public appearances.
So before I came to school today, I had coffee. That's okay. That's okay. All right. Okay, guys. It's okay. Okay, it's okay. It's all right. Listen, I'm going to be talking about a whole range of things today, and I appreciate you guys making your point. Let me go ahead and make mine. All right, and I'll listen to you. You listen to me. All right,
Mr. Obama, you got to do more than listen. You got to do something about the fat cat bankers. You got to do something about Bank of America. You got to do something about corporate lobbyists and homelessness and the whole rest of this economic hornet's nest that puts Wall Street over Main Street.
Although the police carried out New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's order to evict Occupy Wall Street activists and remove their tents and infrastructure from Zuccotti Park with brutal efficiency on November 15th, the park remains a hub of the movement. A recent visit to Zuccotti Park found that a large number of activists remained there, participating in rallies, organizing protests, and conducting daily General Assembly meetings. New York City's Occupy movement showed its strength just 2 days after Bloomberg's raid and on the second month anniversary of their founding, when organizers employed nonviolent civil disobedience in an attempt to close down the New York City Stock Exchange and massed tens of thousands of protesters on a march across the Brooklyn Bridge in what they called a Festival of Lights. Elsewhere around the country, local governments and police are continuing their attempt to suppress the Occupy movement by dismantling encampments and physically assaulting activists. A recent incident where video images captured police officers on the campus of the University of California at Davis attacking activists engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience with pepper spray at point-blank range has generated public outrage at police and renewed support for the movement. Your reporter traveled to New York's Zuccotti Park on November 19th and sat down with two members of the Occupy Wall Street media team, Mark Bray and Senya Berrigan, who talk about how the dismantling of the park has affected their organizing and some of the major issues confronting their fast-growing national movement.
So about 1 o'clock in the morning on that day, Mayor Bloomberg ordered the NYPD to clear out Zuccotti Park or Liberty Square. So they blocked off about 2 or 3 blocks kind of radius, so no one can get in. There was a complete media blackout. No reporters were allowed in. In fact, several were arrested. A councilman was arrested as well and bruised on the head trying to get in to observe. And so in the process, a lot of our fellow occupiers were violently torn from that park. A lot of them were brutalized by the NYPD. And about thousands, I don't know how many, I think 5,000 books, that's more or less the number, thousands of books were destroyed. Computers were destroyed in the process, and a lot of our fellow comrades were pepper sprayed. And so it was, you know, I think it was just a complete act of cowardice in the middle of the night, 1 o'clock in the morning. Young people who have families, who have mothers, who have fathers, who have sisters, who have brothers. These aren't just animals. These are real human beings who are out there for real issues.
I've heard some people say that the park was certainly critical to getting this movement off the ground, you know, in New York and nationally and even internationally. But having been there for almost 8 weeks, people are still there during the day, but you can't camp out and you don't have the infrastructure that you had before. How much of a difference is that going to make in terms of organizing outreach and having the public visibility which made this so powerful?
Well, you're absolutely right that the park was instrumental in getting the movement off the ground to begin with. Obviously, we took the tactic of having a geographic location as a center of our movement and having an encampment from the examples of the Arab Spring and the Indignados in Spain and various movements in France and Greece and so forth. And so, you know, initially I was kind of skeptical of that. I thought it was maybe a shallow imitation of more serious struggles in other parts of the world. But it really has captured the imagination of a wide percentage of the American people. And you know, the issues that we're struggling for, economic justice, democracy, education and healthcare, these are not new issues. Unfortunately, they've been issues for a long time. But the demonstration against it, the protest against it, has been given a renewed vitality through this tactic. And so, you know, it's interesting because when we had the park, a lot of the press said, Well, why do you need a park to have a social movement? Can't you just do it without a park? And now that we've lost the park, the very same press is saying, well, how could you have a social movement without the park? You need the park. So in a strong sense, there's a tendency to try and be negative towards what we're doing, no matter what we do, and we have to put that aside. So, you know, certainly it was a setback. Certainly we would have liked to stay in the park, and it would be insincere to say that we weren't hurt by what happened. But nevertheless, it's important to clarify, and a lot of outsiders don't realize that much of the actual organizing, the organizing meetings, were happening away from the park, if only because there wasn't a lot of space with all the tents and everything. And we have donated office space, storage space, a donated kitchen. We have a large infrastructure and apparatus and network of communication that's outside of the park that wasn't touched by what happened. And so the challenge now, in my mind, is to take the momentum we've gained, because certainly we got much bigger, much faster than anyone could have expected. In a certain sense, we had a movement before an organization. And to use the success and the popularity we've gotten to try and expand throughout the boroughs and make the Occupy movement much bigger than Lower Manhattan.
I had a question for you about national coordination. And that is obviously with the news reports and the leaked information that the police and the government, the federal government, were in ways involved in suppressing this movement. How far along is the coordination between the various groups for some, you know, national actions, as well as some things in the future maybe I'm not even thinking of, and maybe you aren't either? But
We have regular conference calls on different themes among different members of certain working groups. And I think the degree of repression we faced has accelerated our communication, because it's forced us to. And so some of the earliest examples of that really bearing fruit were solidarity marches we had with Oakland, the fact that we donated, $20,000 and 100 tents to their occupation. And I know that a lot of people from the different occupations have come to New York, and when I used to sit in at our press table, I would meet people from North Carolina, from Chicago, from Vermont, from Montreal, Toronto, London, you know, that would come. And, you know, there was a certain sense that we were sort of a hub for this, because we kind of got it going in the United States. And so we've been enhancing our communication and our coordination. And I think you'll see, as time goes along, more days of national action even than we've had in the past. There's already talk potentially of having a national gathering in D.C. in the spring among all the occupiers coming down there. And so it's important, and the technology's made it easier. And I think the nice thing about it is that although people have sort of looked to New York as the start of it, we're trying more and more to shed that title and encourage initiative elsewhere and try to follow along.
That was Occupy Wall Street media team members Mark Bray and Senya Berrigan. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org.
At 13th and K Streets, northwest in D.C., there stands a beautiful abandoned school building, still public property owned by the D.C. government, called Franklin School. It was built in the 1860s, and in 2002, long after it had been closed, a group called Mayday D.C. occupied the building, leading to its use as a homeless shelter for people instead of as an empty building. In 2008, former Mayor Fenty closed the shelter down as business groups wanted the homeless, and especially politically active homeless people associated with Franklin Shelter, moved away from K Street. This year, on the 19th of November, a group called Free Franklin occupied the Franklin School, and Occupy DC swarmed into Franklin Park to back them up. Upon arrival, Occupy DC conducted a puppet show about the history of Franklin School and Franklin Shelter, and the banner was dropped from the building to announce the occupation as the puppet show reached its climax.
Franklin remained empty for a long time. It lost its shine. It got dusty and dirty. Its paint peeled and chipped. It did get a late facelift in the 90s, but that did nothing for its forlorn insides. Scene 3. Franklin makes friends.
Olive Branch community was an activist community house that worked on housing issues. One tactic they used was occupying abandoned houses to demand low-income housing and better services for the homeless. They also like to show up at Mayor Anthony Williams' fancy re-election fundraiser.
Yeah! I was there!
In 2002, The Olive Branch community is raided at gunpoint by police and U.S. Marshals. Residents are evicted from their home and some of their belongings are confiscated by police. In response, 2 days later, activists occupy Franklin School. Yay! They demand better homeless services, more low-income housing, and they demand that vacant public property, like the Franklin, remain in public hands. The occupation only lasts for 1 day. And the mayor agreed to open Franklin as a hypothermia shelter for the winter season. Closed by the city in 2003, claiming complaints from local businesses.
That being McDonald's down that way.
And so activists, again, occupy Franklin School. Joined by more people than last time. The occupation, again, only lasted 1 day, but this time won back Franklin School as Franklin Shelter, the only year-round roll barrier shelter in downtown D.C.
Even though the building was reopened, ongoing attempts to sell Franklin and close the shelter continue, spurring the formation of the Committee to Save Franklin Shelter, a group of homeless residents, advocates, and allies who fight to protect it.
Until 2008, when Mayor Adrian Fenty begins to have all 300 beds of the shelter slowly removed, day by day, until the shelter is shut down. His administration took the position that they had to shut it down because...
we're making great strides to end homelessness.
In response, community members built a tent city across the street, right where you're standing now. But Franklin remains closed.
Interested in selling the building, in 2009, the city asked for proposals from private developers. The decision of what to do with Franklin, whether to sell it to the highest bidder or reopen it for public use, lays in the hands of Mayor Vincent Gray and the city council. In 2010, the mayor's office attempted to declare that Franklin had no further public use, a legal designation that would give the city the right to sell it. Scene 4.
Friends make Franklin. Mic check!
Mic check!
Mic check!
Mic check!
If the city won't give us access,
to
our public property,
then maybe it's time
we take it. Oh yeah!
It took over 3 hours for the police to gain entry to the building and arrest a reported 13 occupiers. The occupiers had brought sleeping bags and equipment for a protracted stay. Occupy DC defended the streets in front of Franklin's walls, twice turning back attempts to use a fire department ladder truck for a window or roof entry.
The fire truck is not going to be permitted to approach. It is being fired. They're not going to a fire. They're going to attempt to evict the people holding Franklin. We have a light out blockade in front of them. They cannot pass. And they back up. Take the side. And they back up again. That's the second attempt to bring a fire ladder into range of the occupation.
Finally, the police forced their way in through the back alley, but had to get past sit-in protesters at the alley exit to get out. Protesters at one of the sit-ins read out why they were there.
I'm here because I love each and every one of you. And I want to see you all do as well as those on top.
I'm here because I work for a retirement community in D.C. that offers affordable Section 8 housing to seniors. And those are the people that live off of Medicare and Medicaid and the people who are getting attacked and people who are told that they don't deserve Medicare. I mean, these folks are the people that built this country, you know. They are not asking for much. They're just asking to survive. And that's why I'm here.
I am here because those who do not have a voice and do not always get a chance deserve to be heard through all views and through all groups. No matter your color, ethnicity, or gender, we are here as a people through different views to change what is our right as a country and as individuals of the American people. Even if not American, you are here to support something greater than that of one person. We are a sea of fish to take this big shark, and we will win, we will prevail, and we will have our voice heard. Woo! Woo!
Woo! The police van loaded with arrestees had trouble leaving the area as protesters blockaded its exit.
Back up! Make a hole, everybody! Make a hole! Make a hole! Make a hole!
Stop, van. Stop, van. Don't let him run you down. Got another one?
Hey, that's not cool.
Easy. Is that a badge number? Driver, get the tag! Get the tag! 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 Get a license tag. We'll identify him. License plate will identify. DC 7537. 7537. 7537. Number 42.
Mr. Mayor, you were elected with a mandate to turn back Fenty's business Uber Ali's policies. Closing Franklin Shelter and selling the building to a developer for a luxury hotel was one of those decisions. DC has yet to sell the building. You can still reopen the shelter to tell Mr. Moneybags on K Street to go sleep in a tent while the homeless sleep in Franklin. Just remember, Mr. Mayor, politics has changed in this city and everywhere. People are willing to fight for the poor and fight for the middle class. The rich had better watch out. Days after Free Franklin occupied the old Franklin School, which used to be Franklin Shelter until 2008, backed by Occupy DC, a number of community groups staged a public meeting at a church just two blocks away.
Saturday afternoon, a group of the folks part of the Occupy DC group and some DC activists decided to do something a little more visible in terms of doing an occupation that would represent not only would people in this city be able to see visitors, but to create the dialogue around how we use public space and how we get community input on how public space all across the District of Columbia should be used by people in the communities where the public property exists.
But then Mayor Finchie closed Franklin Shelter. Did he do it legally?
No. No.
Yes. Because the city has the right to control their space. Now, whether that's moral, now morally, whether or not he should have closed the shelter is a whole different question.
Because it was
about
this time of the year when it was about
to be
cold, right?
During hypothermia, yeah.
Yeah.
But see, the trade-off is that although D.C. is supposed to follow the law, and if any person that requests shelter or emergency shelter in the city is obligated to give to them, the way to work around that was to move folks who were living in Franklin, provide them with transportation, and give them the option of whether or not they could stay in the shelter or not.
You can answer, you have to introduce yourself. My name is Shanae, I live in Franklin Underground. And actually, Fenty did not sort of skirted the law a little bit in the way that he closed it because the city council threw up a roadblock and passed legislation right before it was closed saying that he had to prove that he had placed 300 people in the housing program before he did it.
He didn't.
But what he did is he closed the shelter in a 10-day period right after they passed the legislation, which there's some legal thing where, like, it doesn't take effect then. So rather than vetoing that legislation, he sort of got around all that by passing it in a 10-day
period. Yeah, the judge moved so that you can get 300 people into housing before the due date of the shelter was supposed to be closed down. What he did was he got 150 people out of that building and went to other buildings and got people and just threw them in there. 3 weeks later, 150 people were out of the ship that were in the house and came out of the house because they didn't want to stay in there.
Really, the closing of the Franklin shuttle was a business decision. It really had nothing to do with putting people in the house. It had nothing to do with the dilapidated conditions of the building because men who worked in, like Jesse said, men who worked and lived in that building who had the skills to renovate it, were willing to do sweat equity in their building to bring it up to code. It really was the business improvement district who decided that that was a beautiful parcel, that was a beautiful building, it would be a great boutique hotel, it would be a great luxury condo. The only thing stopping that from happening is you got all these homeless people hanging around the building, and you got to find a creative way to sell this lot to the public, get these folks out, because the sad thing about folks in D.C., the level of consciousness in this city has gone down since I've lived here in the 80s. Mm-hmm. There was a time if a homeless person died in the street, there was a public outcry. Mm-hmm. Now you get 6, 7, 8, 9 people freeze to death, die of hypothermia, hyperthermia, nothing. No investigations, nothing happens. So because of lack of public interest and the fact that the coalition to keep Franklin going broke fell apart, they were able to close the building. But that was a business decision. It had had nothing to do with the money. It had nothing to do with anything other than someone made a phone call, told Fenty, shut it down. That's why I've been sitting here for 3 years.
You're here long enough to get really attached to the Franklin building, and I totally recognize that there's like really powerful symbolism in it, but I also look at it and think that'd be a really hard building to use. It's got really high ceilings, so you got to put a lot of heat energy into it and all those sorts of things. So what I'm curious about is what work has been done looking at the whole picture of public property to say, you know, which ones are actually the most, you know, doable, particularly looking through a lens of, like, how can we create self-sufficient projects? Because I hear that, you know, business decisions are a lot of what drives what happens, and, you know, if there's a way that we can start creating vacant land to do, like, urban farming, you know, that could, like, provide jobs for people that would reduce the need for shelters.
But it's not going to solve our employment, the shortage of employment in this city. And although the Franklin building might be drafty or what have you, I mean, there aren't any, like, high-tech, you know, buildings that are available and that could be potentially used as a space downtown close to where there are jobs that exist. Because, you know, the way urban farming is going to work is if people have part-time employment and they're working on a rooftop garden or something like that, and having the space where people can sleep right down here where the job, where, you know, many of the jobs are, as folks have said, is really important. The idea that, you know, it's sort of a business, how it's going to affect business is how these decisions are made, I think is something that we need to push back on as opposed to figuring out how can we conform to that. It's more like how can we shift the terms of the debate so that that's not how decisions are made. And I think that's one of the things that where, you know, the Occupy movement has actually, although not having a list of demands or whatever, has actually shifted the terms of the debate on that. So seeing that movement converge with this local work that's been going on for years, I think is where we're going to start to get, you know, more concrete, and it's going to take more discussions like this to get really more concrete.
I feel like I'm one of those activists in D.C. who's been part of a lot of different campaigns and feeling a little bit disappointed by a lot of those different campaigns because the road always leads to city council. And then, like we talked about Franklin Shelter, within, even though you have a win, within 10 days something, you know, they're about, the mayor is able to get around things. Not that they haven't been wins and there hasn't been amazing work done by local organizations like LEDC, like Empower DC, like One DC. I feel a concern rising in terms of how folks in this room, we might have ideas about urban farming and all these amazing ideas in terms of what can be done with this space. But I think that what's missing is actually that who should be making these decisions. And by trying to put forth even our own proposals and ideas, we might be replicating what the government does in terms of leaving out voices. What I would personally like to say, and I'm not alone in this, is actually the homeless community are being able to actually, people being able to put in energy to create an alternative community needs assessment.
What I want to say is that D.C. government tends to take lessons from New York City's government on a number of different things, like permanent supportive housing and a few other things. And so what I think is that we can actually take a lesson from our equals in New York City. There's a man named Rob Robinson who actually is director of a thing called Picture the Homeless. Right. And I believe that they have a website where as people go through the city, going about their business, if they find a vacant property that can be used for something, they go to the website and they put it up on the website. So we should have some sort of website or centralized location where people from all over the city can tap in and say, I saw this property that should be rehabbed and used for something. And then we get all the information in one place, basically. And then we can kind of go from there with the master facilities plan or whatever and go to the city with an organized plan of what it is that we want to do with these different properties.
So I'm here both as a D.C. resident for about 7 years and as somebody who's been a part of the Occupy movement a little bit. And I'm here because both I'm interested and very concerned about the lack of public spaces in D.C. and the cuts to the ones that exist currently, the few that do.
In the aftermath of the November 19th occupation of Franklin School, which used to be Franklin Shelter until former Mayor Finney closed it, a lot of members of the D.C. government are suddenly whining that they don't like Occupy D.C. anymore, and some of the mainstream media are following suit. On the 23rd of November, WTOP Radio ran a nasty hatchet job against Occupy D.C., featuring D.C.'s Mayor Gray whining about the cost to the government of Occupy D.C.'s exercise of their First Amendment rights.
The Occupy D.C. movement has been here for more than 2 months, and the cost to taxpayers is growing. Now the question becomes, how much longer can local governments afford to let them stay here?
D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray says the impact to the city's budget is now part of the equation when deciding how to deal with the protesters. So far, the cost to D.C. taxpayers?
Around $1 million. Largely, of course, the police activity.
Speaking on WTOP's Ask the Mayor program, Gray said part of the problem is the occupiers seem to be settling in for the long haul.
We don't have any estimate on how long this will go, nor how long, you know, our budget can handle these kinds of costs.
Gray says it's a delicate balance of free speech, public safety, and now money. That's why he may ask the federal government to help with the growing costs.
That is certainly a possibility, especially since there are federal properties that are involved here.
Mark Seagraves, WTOP News.
Hey, WTOP, freedom isn't free and never has been.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
The announcement by the Democratic and Republican chairs of the Congressional Supercommittee that they had failed to reach agreement on cutting the nation's deficit by $1.2 trillion over the next decade was greeted by some with disappointment, but many others were relieved that proposed severe austerity measures were off the table, at least for now. President Obama and congressional legislators from both parties have consistently discussed their desire to reach a so-called grand bargain that would reach deficit reduction targets, largely by invoking draconian cuts in benefits for recipients of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in exchange for some modest tax increases. The deal that brought about the 12-member joint House-Senate supercommittee endowed with extraordinary powers came out of Tea Party Republican obstruction of an extension of the national debt ceiling that many saw as a tactic to extort concessions on budget cuts. This maneuver brought the federal government uncomfortably close to default and resulted in the downgrading of the U.S. bond rating in August. Now, with the failure of the supercommittee, an automatic $1.2 trillion in cuts will be made from both the defense and domestic budgets unless Congress arrives at a new agreement. But while Tea Party politicians push for austerity measures, accompanied by their slogan that government is the enemy, may have gone virtually unchallenged over the last 2 years, the exponential growth of the new Occupy Wall Street movement and the popularity of their message decrying economic inequality and political corruption may have changed the political climate in Washington. The Democrats' uncharacteristic refusal to cave in to GOP demands may be attributed to the power of the Occupy movement. Your reporter spoke with Richard Wolf, professor of economics at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. He assesses the power of the Occupy Wall Street movement and how the European economic crisis could be a preview of the battles ahead here in the U.S.
You know, it wasn't that many months ago that all we heard about was the Tea Party. Now we barely read about the Tea Party. We read about Occupy this, Occupy that, and the next thing. It is extraordinary. They have raised these basic questions about our economic system, the unfairness of it, the 99 versus 1%, but they've had the courage we haven't seen in 50 years in the United States. They are questioning our economic system, capitalism by name, and they're saying it's long overdue. For 50 years, we've debated our educational system, our transportation system. Last year, we had a national debate about our health system. But one thing is off limits. One thing is a taboo, our economic system. So we don't debate and criticize and see if we can do better the way we ought to in a healthy society. We've had a taboo because of the Cold War and because of the kind of hysterical anti-communism that has suffused our country all these years. And this is a movement that is questioning all that and doing it in a straightforward and honest way, resisting the efforts of the authorities to squelch it, of the police to intimidate it. It is amazing what has been done in 2 months, and every sign points to this being a movement in the early stages of changing the United States. And I think it's an incredible time to be alive and to be able to watch, and even better, to participate.
Now, I wonder, from the perspective of someone who's seen movements come and go and protests come and go, do you see what's developed here with the Occupy Wall Street movement as a transformative movement versus a short-lived series of protests?
In the years since I've been born and lived my life in the United States, I've seen protest movements, but most of them have been focused on single issues: the concern for civil liberties, the concern for civil rights, for the right to have your own sexual orientation, for the right of immigrants to have a decent chance at the American dream, and all of that. And I noticed each time that the movements were specific, they were around a single issue, and when they tried to broaden out, they were told, even by their friends, it's too dangerous, don't raise these basic questions about American society, it'll only divide you, it'll get you in trouble. And that's what contributed to keeping the economic system from being subjected to the normal criticism that we use to subject to other systems to make them better. It was part of a way that even the critics of our society, who were trying to make it better, shied away from facing the economic realities of our system. And this is the first movement I've ever seen that doesn't shy away, that puts it front and center, that says, look, beyond the particular issues we disagree about, 99% of us know in our hearts that this is a system that is making the rich richer and everybody else is having a harder time, and that's basic, and that unites us. And if we focus on that, we can make the biggest, most far-reaching changes that this country needs, and we can do it because we'll all be together. That kind of unity, that kind of overcoming of the fragmentation that has afflicted critical social movements in the past, that is an enormous, transformative new start in the United States.
Well, Professor Wolf, before you go, maybe you can talk about the battle going on right now in Europe over austerity policies that are being foisted on the people of Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal and Ireland and other nations, and the resistance we see developing in the streets. Where is that battle headed? And do you think that the result of the conflicts in Europe may usher in some new economic structures that will be fair and that will maybe displace the euro as the common currency, but in the end will spare the people of Europe from these draconian policies that are coming down on them from a hierarchy that they don't seem to be able to control?
You know, I think that we ought to pay close attention to Europe, because Europe is shaping up to be our future that we can look at before we arrive at it, and maybe we can navigate our future a little bit better by paying close attention to the pre-war of it in Europe now. Basically, you're seeing in Europe a fundamental civil conflict between the business community, the banks, and the politicians that they control, trying to maintain the power, trying to respond to this crisis, which gets deeper each year, by policies that protect their dominance in the society. And on the other hand, the mass of people who don't see their interests being represented, who see the crisis as an assault on their well-being, who see the government's handling of it a further assault on their well-being, and who have now dug in their heels and said, this crisis is your fault. The recovery you made served only you. You're not now going to make us pay for your failed economic system and your failed political system on top of it. But the punchline here is the exact same battle over the exact same issues is what's going on in the United States. The details are different. The basic story is the same.
That was Richard Wolf, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, now a visiting professor at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. His latest book is titled Capitalism Hits the Fan. Find links to Professor Wolf's articles on our website at btlonline.org.
Here's a special call out to the Northern Rockies Independent Media Center in Bozeman, Montana. Now rebroadcasting WSQT Online. And just like we have Occupy DC, there's Occupy Bozeman. On the 12th of November, Occupy Bozeman picketed a Wells Fargo bank. You may recall the history of Wells Fargo from the Old West. There's also some very special history concerning the Bozeman Trail in Montana. That was where Red Cloud fought the United States government until the United States government agreed to surrender unconditionally and abandoned the Bozeman Trail. We also know the shameful history that came later. The United States abandoned the Bozeman Trail but built the Transcontinental Railroad. The United States went back on their word to the Lakota, like they went back on their word to every Native American tribe they ever encountered, in their manifest destiny, greed and limitless expansion.
After serving 20 years as sheriff of Arizona's Maricopa County, Joe Arpaio, a strong ally of the right-wing Tea Party movement, could be in political trouble. On election night, Arpaio stood next to defeated State Senate President Russell Pierce, an anti-immigrant ally who lost a recall election driven by moderate Republicans and Latino voters. It was the second big defeat for Arpaio in 2 years. Former county attorney Andrew Thomas, who devised the legal rationale for Arpaio's immigrant raids, lost the GOP primary for Arizona Attorney General in 2010. Arpaio now faces two federal Justice Department investigations involving charges that he abused his office and violated the civil rights of Latinos. In 2010, the Justice Department sued Arpaio for access to records in the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, which includes Phoenix and surrounding suburbs. At the time of the lawsuit in 2010, Arpaio stated, "They are not going to put handcuffs on this sheriff. I am not going to surrender." In recent months, Arpaio inserted himself into the 2012 GOP presidential primary race by deputizing his cold case posse to investigate President Obama's birth certificate and considering endorsements for Herman Cain, Mitt Romney, and Michelle Bachmann. Even though a strong challenger has not yet emerged, Sheriff Arpaio is expecting a tough re-election fight in 2012. Randy Perez, who organized the successful recall campaign against Russell Pierce, has his sights set on Arpaio and his extremist brand of politics. On the 16th anniversary of the hanging of Nigerian activist Ken Sarowiwa, Amnesty International is calling on Royal Dutch Shell to pay $1 billion in damages for the company's two 2008 oil spills in the Niger Delta, affecting the lives of 69,000 people. The two spills from a Shell pipeline occurred in the town of Bodo, a rural community that relies on fishing and farming for its survival. Shell failed to stop the first leak in August 2008 for 2 weeks. Amnesty estimates more oil leaked in this spill than from the Exxon Valdez disaster in 1989. Currently, the fight over monetary damages is tied up in a British court. Shell blames the oil spills on sabotage, denying that poor maintenance of the pipeline was responsible. Amnesty claims the oil spills directly harmed the health of villagers in Bodo by contaminating the community's drinking water supply. Air quality in the region has also deteriorated as the warm sun releases oil fumes. Militant groups in the region, like the Movement to Emancipate the Niger Delta, or MEND, are resuming their operations, which have included kidnappings and attacks on foreign oil company workers. The situation had been quiet since 2009, when the Nigerian government offered amnesty to top MEND commanders. But rebel leaders now complain of broken government promises and a deadly legacy of decades of oil pollution in the Niger Delta.